Well, once again, I started by telling you folks I couldn't believe you're coming out on a Saturday, so I'll end by saying that too. It's good to see you. You might wonder, Matt picked these topics. You might wonder what this third one has to do with the others, but there's a practical side of apologetics too. It's not just about debating and winning debates and winning arguments and showing people up. Well, that shouldn't be part of apologetics anyway. But there's a practical side to apologetics. And probably for the last 20 years, I've just been really convicted that apologists should be able to use apologetic arguments and practical ministry to get people over rough spots in their life. It's not only for unbelievers to lead them to Christ, although I will say, this is a whole nother topic, but I will just add in, if I were writing this out, I would add what I call with my students an informational footnote. It's amazing how the Lord uses this material to bring skeptics to the Lord. It happens far more frequently than you may think. And guys who are into this full time and who specialize in some of these things, they can tell you the most incredible testimonies you've ever heard. In fact, a couple of the guys who are here this weekend, I don't want to blow anybody's cover, but there's some really incredible supernatural type testimonies among some people who are here. And so it's not just to like bolster up the faith and put 2x4s up against the walls and make sure no one's going to break in. There is a whole side of apologetics which sees people come to the Lord. And I'll add one thing to that and then move on, because we are talking about the area of doubt. And these people who come, I have had probably 500, I'm not a counselor, but I've had probably 500 discussions with doubters. And you'd probably be surprised how many of those are non-Christian doubters. They doubt too. They have questions. But about the most important thing, if you work with an unbeliever and your friends, and they either listen to you or you spar backwards and forwards, and because you're friends, it's cool, and so on. I'd say the most important thing next to the gospel material itself is to develop a friendship. If it's the kind of fly-by-night, crush the guy when you pass him in the lunchroom, that generally is going to be a sparring session, and that's about where it ends. But if you have friendship with unbelievers, I mean the kind that says, hey, the football game's on tomorrow, why don't you come on over? And he or she knows what you're saying. They know you're saying, let's talk, but you're just above board with it. That's the kind of people who, with prayer, often come to Christianity. And you may really be surprised when it happens. But I was challenged by a guy 20 years ago why apologists don't see more people come to the Lord. And a lot of apologists say, well, that's because we go to university campuses and we're only there for 2 nights, and you can't start a church and bring people in and 2 nights. But there's a little bit of where you suspect that's kind of a cop-out too. And when you start paying attention to people, and if you're willing to answer their emails, and some of them will say, please call me, I'd love to talk to you, I'm having serious questions, and they'll chat, it's just amazing how many of those people come to the Lord and do it long term. I don't mean, you know, 2 weeks later they don't believe. I don't mean that. So I'm going to talk about Christians who doubt. But I'm just letting you know with this little opening that there are non-Christians who doubt too. And sometimes the Lord can use us to answer their questions and to see practical things happen. I think there's a lot of practical uses of apologetics. All right, having said that, it's very possible that doubt is the most common issue, quote unquote, that you see among believers. Why? Because almost all Christians question at some time. That's because almost all human beings question at some time. That's because you're a human being. I think doubt comes from the combination of being finite and from a biblical viewpoint, being sinners. You get that combination together. Being finite just means we don't know everything. And if you're a person who's inquisitive, you're intelligent, a lot of things can go into this, but you're just getting into questions. Why does God let bad things happen to good people? And so on. So it's very, very common. And I almost never meet a Christian. I think I've met one in my entire life doing this who says, I've never had a doubt. Almost all Christians go through it at some time. But here's the problem. According to psychological testing, I work with a clinical psychologist who works in a psychiatric, works with psychiatrists as his in a hospital situation. And he's been testing with me. I don't do the testing, but he has been testing for about 15 years. And we're just getting ready to publish some material in secular psych journals. And it's really, really interesting. Doubt is a hot topic today, even among unbelievers. And most doubt is not caused for factual reasons. So that's just a little introduction. Keep that in mind. I'm going to come back to that. Let me start with the definition. I'm going to define doubt. Now, again, it's in a context of religious doubt. This isn't doubt in general. Religious doubt, and I'm going to specify Christians who doubt. That's why I started out with that little informational footnote about non-Christians. I'm not really going to be able to come back to that. This is an area where there's loads of data. I'll define doubt as questions or uncertainty regarding God or our relationship to Him. Questions or uncertainty regarding God or our relationship to Him. Now, let me begin by giving you a few examples. You have a place there in your notes for some examples. Sometimes questions are factual questions. I just wonder where you Christians, well, I'm wording this like a non-Christian, so let me word it like a Christian asking questions. How do we know the Bible's the Word of God? How do we know the Bible's a good text? How do you know creation's true? How do we know God exists? How do we know Jesus was raised from the dead? Now, those sound like factual questions. I'm going to give a caveat in a few minutes, but those can be factual questions. They don't have to be factual questions, but they can be. Okay, here's a second kind of question. Well, I don't have any question Christianity's true, this doubter says. I don't have any question Christianity's true. I just wonder if I'm a Christian. I just lack personal assurance. You probably hear that a fair amount. When I was in the pastorate many years ago, that's probably the most common question I got from Christians. How do I know I'm a believer? All right, here's another one. How come bad things happen to good people? The problem of suffering. It's claimed, I don't know how you're going to show this objectively, but it's claimed that that's the most commonly asked question. Certainly of unbelievers who doubt, but probably believers too. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do we suffer? And of course, that gets into sovereignty, free will, and a number of other interesting topics. And then lastly, this is the way I hear the question in the last 15 years. I've got a book back there on the table devoted to this topic. Why is God silent? Or the title of my book is, Why is God Ignoring Me? Why doesn't God answer our prayers? Why don't we hear from him more often? So I'm just giving you examples. Is Christianity true? Oh, I'm sure Christianity is true, but what about assurance? How do I know I'm a member of that group? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why does God so frequently seem to be silent? Those are very common issues. All right. Now, I can't think of a topic concerning which there are more misbeliefs than this topic. Doubt is really convoluted. Now, I'm going to state a bunch of things. There's no magic number, but you've got room for a bunch of things in your notes. I sometimes do 10 or I do 12. I won't do that many today. But here's some misbeliefs, and I'm going to state them incorrectly, okay? I'm going to state them as misbeliefs. Here's what I often hear about doubt. Doubt is mostly for intellectuals. You hear that commonly. Now remember, I'm stating this incorrectly, but this is what people say. Doubt is mostly for intellectuals. Or here's another one. Doubt is solved by a course in apologetics. Just learn the evidences. Actually, it almost never is. Doubt is sinful. That'll make you not ask questions if you believe it's sinful. How about this one? I heard this one a lot. Doubt is the unpardonable sin. Doubt is the unpardonable sin. Because what you're saying is you're questioning God. You just question the God of the universe. That's the unpardonable sin. How about doubt gets worse the older you get? Doubt never occurs to biblical heroes. I'm stating all these incorrectly. Let me keep reminding you of that. Doubt never happens to biblical heroes. Or sort of a cognate of that would be doubt doesn't preach. And you know, if you have that view, you let people kind of stew in their doubts because you don't talk about them. They think they're the only one that has them. And then when they hear that other people have them, it's like, whoa, do you have these questions too? And then all of a sudden you got a best friend, somebody to talk to. But you never brought it up before because another misbelief is doubt is the opposite of faith. That's also false. It can be, but it's not necessarily. There are a number of Greek words for doubt in the New Testament, and usually it means to be caught in between two positions. Remember the fellow who came to Jesus and wanted a healing, and he said, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. That's probably the best picture of doubt. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. I'm not a full believer, and I'm not a full unbeliever. Just, yeah, I'm with you. I believe you can do this, but help that part of me that thinks you can't do it. Or James talking about a man being tossed to and fro by the waves of the sea. Doubt usually means being caught between two positions, not rejecting. We have a Greek word for rejecting. Pistuo or pistis is faith. Apistis, just like atheism, no theism. Amillennial, no millennium, no literal millennium. Apistis means no faith. But doubt can take on, in the New Testament, it can take on that sense of unbelief. But it usually means to be caught in between, to be in a quandary. All right, so those are some examples of unbeliefs. All right, there are different families of, is that the next thing on your notes? Different families? Species, families, different species. Now let me define three for you quickly, and then I'm going to very quickly, the rest of this time will be on one, just one of them, the most common. All right, the first kind of doubt is factual or philosophical doubt. And these are the true questions like, how do I know the Bible is the Word of God? How do I know God exists? How do I know there's an afterlife? Was Jesus really raised from the dead? Factual or philosophical questions. You might think those are the most common kinds of doubt, but they're not. In the surveys we've taken, and this clinical psychologist has given people a battery of psychological tests along with a little questionnaire that we've come up with that identifies doubt that we're trying to publish. And only about 15% of doubters are factual doubters. Don't be misled by the way people ask questions. Men in particular usually ask questions in factual ways. But it doesn't follow that they're factual doubters. Two people could ask this question. How do I know that the Bible's God's word? And one can mean it factually, and one can mean it totally differently. So I'll tell you here in a second. All right, so that's factual doubt. It's about 15%. Let me flip to the third one. Leave your second one open. And I'll tell you why I do it in this order. But the third kind is what I call volitional doubt. And I think it's there in your notes, top of page two. Is that two pages? Okay. Volitional doubt. Now, all doubt, in a way, is volitional, right? Because you've chosen to do it. But that's not what I mean. I'm not using volitional generically there, but I'm going to use it specifically. And let me define this one by example instead of by giving you a textbook definition. And I did this the other day in another context, and someone came up to me and said, please talk to me, that's my dad. And they started telling me, and it was just like, he just fit this case to a T. All right, here's my example of volitional doubter. An individual, often a fellow, often a guy, is a leader in a church. He's a lay leader, maybe even a pastor. But this person's a lay leader, and they've held almost every important position in church. They've been a deacon, they've been an elder, Sunday school teacher, Sunday school superintendent. They hold several positions, but all of a sudden, I mean, it seems all of a sudden to you, it's not like that in their life, there's a process, but to you, it looks like all of a sudden they drop out of church. And they've been to church for 5, 10, 15, 30 years, haven't been to church. Now let's say you're a buddy of theirs, fishing buddy, football buddy. So you take a little more liberty than the average person would. You go, come on, let's go golf or let's go fish or I want to talk to you. I don't want to talk about it. No, we're going to talk about this. And you can push because you're a good friend. And you say to the person, man, you know, we haven't seen you around. Your wife goes, your kids go. You haven't been there for so long. I'm really concerned about you. Yeah, well, don't worry about me. What's with you? Do you disbelieve Christianity? No, I don't disbelieve it at all. I think it's probably true. Then why are you a dropout? Doesn't meet my needs anymore. It's not important to me. It's true, but not everything that's true is important. Why is it not important to you? Well, if you know the person, this is for a good friend to do because you can push. Oz Guinness, in his book on doubt, calls this a time to warn. Sometimes you have to nicely get in somebody's face. And I'm not very good at that. But when you do it, it should be with a friend, somebody you respect each other enough, you can push, and other people can't push. Like you can. You know what kind of, you know, you maybe your name's coming to your mind. You know somebody like this. And you can push. You say, you don't think Christianity is false? No, I don't think it's false. I think it's probably true. Why aren't you out here anymore? I don't want to talk about it. No, what's going on? Anyway, you push a little bit and you find out the person's hurting. Something's happened. Someone's dogged them. They were in a church, pastor, senior pastor had an affair. Their husband or wife left them, and they were a great Christian family, and they connect it with the emotional hurt, but now it's way past that. They're remarried, the pastor is no longer the pastor of that church, but the hurt remains. You say, well, it sounds more emotional than volitional. It does, but the reason I do it in this order, the second one's going to be emotional. The reason I do it factual, emotional, volitional is because this is not always, but this is very frequently the way doubt progresses. If there's an order, probably the most common order is factual, emotional, volitional. And it starts as a question. And a factual question, well, I'll tell you what a physician friend of mine said to me one time. I played hockey and football and basketball all my life, and I never got hurt playing hockey, never got hurt playing football. Three times I got hurt playing basketball. I'm like, well, how does that happen? So I tear my leg up, you know, and I end up with a cast and played college basketball, even though I am not good at it. Last time I did it, I broke one side of my ankle and tore the ligament on the other side. And my physician friend said, if you have a choice, I can ask this if you agree, if you have a choice, he said, if it's a simple break, take the break every time. Breaks are better than ligament tears. Agreed? Generally? He was just being general, but he said, your ligament will never heal totally. You're gonna, you know, you'll twist it once in a while and it'll be sore. All right, now, he said a clean break is better than a tear. And, you know, now, let me use that example with doubt. The time to get doubt is when it's kind of a simple factual question. Is this true? Yeah, and let me give you five reasons. Okay, thanks. I needed that. Catch you later. Doubt can be a fairly simple, it can be a really tough question, like only certain people can set broken bones, and only certain people can answer certain questions, but at that stage it hasn't gotten complicated. But a factual question that's not answered often festers, it often gets infected, goes a little further. And doubts that aren't answered right away, because it could be for a variety of reasons. I don't want to tell anybody. I don't want you to think I'm an unbeliever. I don't want you to think I walked away from the faith. So I don't tell you. And then when my question's not answered, it really bothers me, and I start getting upset with God because God's not answering my questions. And now it's complicated because I just don't, not only do I not have an answer to my faith, now I'm angry about it. I'm just a little ticked. Now, before I get angry, chances are I get worried first, get a little anxious. Wow, what if it's not true? What if Christianity is false, like some of my friends say? What if? What if? What if? Which is a good, a fair indicator of that there may be some anxiety there. I've already told you, I'm not a counselor. I teach a PhD course in philosophy of psychology. It's an area I deal with, but not because I'm a counselor, but because I deal with some of the theory. And we found in this testing that emotional doubt usually loads pretty directly on anxiety. But doubt that is factual and fairly simple, but untended, so therefore it gets a little emotional, when it goes on for a long time, that's when it often changes to anger. And volitional doubt, the guy who hasn't darkened the door of a church for 30 years, he doesn't think it's false, he just doesn't think it meets his needs. That person frequently loads on depression and anger. Anger and depression. They're just ticked. So So that's why I do it in that order. Catch doubt when it's uncomplicated. Best time to catch it. You set a bone when you know it's broken. You don't set it 3 months later. Doubt, like I said, often festers. It's emotional, and that's when it's this, oh, no, no, I'm not walking away from my faith. I'm totally in love with the Lord. I just wonder, what if it's not true? And that third stage is frequently that, who cares? God had a shot, could answer my prayer, didn't do it. He ignores me. And what do you do with people who you thought loved you, but they ignore you and they don't meet your needs? What do you say? Sometimes in marriage, it's sort of, you stay in your half of the house and I'll stay in my half of the house. It's like avoidance. And that's what we do with God. That's the last stage. And that's Oz Guinness's time to warn. Now, I'd talk about all three of these kinds of doubt. Matter of fact, I just got done teaching a PhD course in dealing with doubt. There's a lot of data here. But the one I want to slow down on is the middle one, emotional doubt. Okay, why is that? Because emotional doubt is by far the most common, by far the most painful, and most likely the least dangerous. See, again, it's those catch-22s. It's those funny things. There's more twists and turns about this. It's very common, maybe as high as 70%. We haven't tallied all the stats yet, but from what we've been able to define, we've done two rounds of testing with hundreds of people, hundreds of adults. And we get about the same number of factual and volitional doubters, but a high portion of emotional doubters. And the way you go after this, the most common way to deal with it is deal with it as an emotional struggle. Deal with it the way you deal with emotional hurt. So you can read a good book on dealing with emotional hurt and you say, well, that book's not a doubt, but the remedy might be very similar. So let me give you two paths that you can use. This topic's another one where I run out of time really quickly. So I'm gonna move right on. Let me give you a psychological path out of this, and let me give you a biblical path. And I think they're not different paths. I think they both correspond to each other very, very nicely. But some people don't like psychology and they think psychology is evil, and I don't share that view at all. But some people want to hear it biblically, so I'll give you both. Psychologically, I never liked psychology. A lot of reasons for that. But when people started coming to talk to me, they found out that I went through 10 years of doubt, and I went through all three, and they thought, well, can I come talk to you? And this is part of that is apologetics practical thing. So I wanted to spend some time with them and act in a pastoral manner and deal with them. But I started changing my views because I used to think that the answer to doubt is a good course in apologetics. And then I found out that these guys weren't getting better. I would answer their questions. They go, thanks, that's helpful. And they'd be right back in to see me a week later. And I can tell you what's going to happen. In a high percentage of cases, I mean, when you talk to 500 doubters, here's what happens. When they leave your office, it's like, woo, thank you. That was a great help. And the next day, they feel 90% better. The next day, it's 70% better. And the next day, it's 50% better. And next week, they're 10% better, and they come in to see you again. But anxiety often works that way. And you have to do something other than give a factual answer because it's become emotional. It's sort of like some sort of sickness where you need two medicines to take care of it, and you've only got one of them. You might do a little bit better, but you're not going to get over it. Sort of like that. You need something for the factual component, but you need something for the emotional component too. I'm not implying, I mean, you might need drugs, but that's not my point. My point is just to say it's like a sickness where you need two medicines. All right, so I went back to school. I thought, well, I've got a lot to learn about this, so I'll go back and study. And I went back postdoctorally and decided to do some clinical stuff And I studied under a guy who, in the field, psychologists are pretty strange in this, they will often vote on the most influential people in their field. These polls are kind of well known. And I went back and studied under the guy who was the best known psychotherapist in the world, Albert Ellis. He died a few years ago. And he was Freudian, and then he rejected Freudianism, and in the 1950s, he started a movement that a lot of others have jumped on the bandwagon, and it's often called cognitive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. And he popularized a truth that could be one of the most liberating things you'll ever learn after salvation and maybe a few other things. It's very, very liberating. There's different forms of this, but the one Ellis is really well known for is called ABC. And it works like this. We think that the most painful things in life that happen to us are precisely that. They're things that people do to us, or a disease that I have, or the car accident, or the way my boss treats me, or my spouse, or, you know, I've got a bad back now, or, and they can be. Things that happen to you can be very painful. Sometimes they can be the most painful thing. But Ellis and other cognitive therapists, some of them are MDs, some of them are psychiatrists, some of them are PhDs, clinical psychologists, and they claim now that there are hundreds of experiments that will indicate the truth of this next comment, which is kind of bombastic, and that is oftentimes in life, not always, but oftentimes in life, the most painful thing that can happen to you is not what other people do or what you get yourself into or what you develop as in a disease, but how you download what happens to you. How do you characterize this to yourself? What do you say to yourself? For example, somebody might say, well, I'll give you an example. In 1995, my wife died of stomach cancer. I just sit there and, you know, watch. She was very small anyway, small stature, 5'2", 105 pounds. And I watched while she lost almost half her body weight. We had four children. Two of them were pretty young, 9 and 12. She was only 43 years old. And she died after just 4 months after diagnosis. So she was, because of some medicine she was taking, she was sleeping 17, 18 hours a day. My kids were in school, and I would take a child monitor and put it up in the room, and I was just getting warm. We got back from the hospital in first week of May, and I would sit on the front porch and have this make-believe discussion with God. I often think of it like Job chapter 38, where Job had his time with God. And I would ask God, you know, conversationally, because I don't think I ever got angry, but I was, I'm not saying that's a sin, I'm just saying me. And I'd say, well, Lord, she's only 43, and we've got four children, and my youngest kids are only 9 and 12. And I pictured the Lord talking to me. It was very therapeutic, thinking what he might say to me, how he might counsel me, what would my Job 38 look like. And what Ellis would say about this is the most painful thing is not what's happening to your wife, as painful as that is. I told my closest friends the worst possible thing has come upon me. She's my best friend in the world. But what really causes a lot of pain is when you download it like this. I'll never be the same again. I'll never be happy. I'll never be well adjusted. I'll never find anybody else. I'll never be in love again. I'll never have a soulmate. That's the worst possible thing that can happen to me. And we all do those kind of things when we're in pain. We say those sorts of things. And those things are very, very painful. And we think it's the accident or the boss or the someone mistreating us. We think it's those things. But again, there's been hundreds of experiments that what happens to us emotionally largely comes from what we say or believing what other people say to you, owning things, downloading things. And that's the cause of a lot of the what-ifs in life, you know. And so what you do, how you treat this, what these psychologists and psychiatrists who work in these areas will tell you to do, whether they're Christian or non-Christian, they give you about the same remedy. You go after the things you say to yourself that are not true. In the words of one book, let me recommend a book to you. It's by two Christian psychotherapists. The guy also has a master's degree in theology, and he's also a pastor, but he's got a PhD in clinical psychology. The book is called Telling Yourself the Truth. It's a bestseller. So by being a bestseller, I'm saying it's well-written and easy to read, or it wouldn't be a bestseller. And Telling Yourself the Truth, and his name is William Backus, B-A-C-K-U-S. Her name is Marie Chapian, C-H-A-P-I-A-N, two PhDs. And they call their system misbelief therapy. And it's based on three words. The words stand for rules, but locate, remove, and replace. Locate the lies you tell yourself. Argue against them. That's not true because. And then you replace the lies with truth. Locate, remove, and replace. But the main thing, some people just, a lot of therapists just do it in two steps. Locate your lies, argue against them. So let's start applying this to Christianity. Well, first of all, let me just stop here for a second to show you. I have to get some audience participation here for a moment. All I need you to do is raise your hand. I won't have anybody. I won't call on anybody. I won't embarrass anybody. But you need to see how common this is, okay? How widespread emotional doubt is. How many of you, after salvation, okay, it's got to be after salvation, you trusted Christ, you made a step, you're stepping out of faith. How many of you, after salvation, have wondered whether you're going to get to heaven and Jesus is going to say with his left hand, depart from me, I never knew you. And you go, but, and you're already kicked out and you're on your way to hell. I mean, that's kind of graphic, but how many of you, after salvation, you've entertained the possibility that you could be, unbeknownst to yourself, you could be unsaved? How many of you? If, folks, some of you in the back can see this, but some of you in the front, it was just a quick look, but I'd say it was like 90%, 85% of the hands went up. Why do we do that to ourselves? Okay, now you say, well, because I'm nervous. Well, yeah, you're nervous. That's what it is. That's anxiety. But why? Here's some of the unbeliefs. What are you saying to yourself? You're saying, here's some misbeliefs. Maybe Jesus sends saved people to hell. Now, that didn't sound right. All right, let me say it a different way. And depending on how you word these things, you're saying things that can cause a lot of pain internally. It's sort of like saying, what if my spouse is untrue to me? Do you have any reason to think that? No, none whatsoever. But you know, a lot of other people thought that, and they turned out they were, so I'm going to hire somebody. You know how that works. And we can mistrust. We can mistrust God the same way. What if I'm not saved? What if Christianity is not true? And that can be very, very painful. You know why? Because usually in anxiety, you question what is most important to you. You don't question what's not important to you. Let me give you a little example. I love this thing my mom told me once. When my mom got married at a really young age, so you know this was like a long time ago. She was 18. My brother and I were born pretty quickly afterwards. Just 3 years later, she had two little children. And one day, we were both fairly sick. I had 105 temperature. My brother had 104 temperature. And she thought, well, it's about time to take the boys to the doctors. And she took us. And the physician said, ma'am, it's the flu. I've seen a lot of cases this week. I can't give you anything. We can't treat. You know, we can't give you an antibiotic for a virus, but here's what you do. You take the boys home, give them a lot of sleep, a lot of liquids. And then he added this sentence. He said, he could see my mom was real agitated. And he said, ma'am, if they were my boys, I wouldn't worry about them. And my mom said the following sentence. She didn't say it, but the following sentence came into her mind. No offense, but if they were your boys, I wouldn't be worried. The problem is they're my boys, and so I'm worried. All right, That's the way this works. If you didn't care about your faith, you wouldn't worry about it. But you don't stop to think about that. You go, oh no. Pastor asked a question. That one hurt a little bit. And then you say this, I wonder if the Lord, that's Holy Spirit agitation, because the Lord's telling me I'm not saved. Wow, now it's really hurting, because I just said, what if I'm not saved? And I stepped it up a little bit more, and I'm close to having an anxiety attack or something here. This isn't cool. Well, we've hyped it up by what we're saying to ourselves. And the reason it's important to me and the reason I'm really hurting is because I'm asking myself questions that really make a difference. See, I'm asking about my kids. I don't want your kids getting sick, but I'm asking about my kids, right? Or I'm asking about my faith. So I'll say to people, if they come in and talk, I'll say, do you always worry about things that don't matter to you? What? Yeah, do you always worry about things that don't matter to you? What do you mean? Well, didn't you just say to me you would give an arm and a leg to know that you loved God? Yeah? So you always worry about things that you don't love, right? No, I see where you're going. I wouldn't be worried if I wasn't loved. Not that it'd prove you're a Christian, but it does prove that you care. It does prove that it's really important to you. I had a lady tell me one time across the desk, she said, I'd give you my right arm if I could know I was a Christian. And I said, yeah. And she goes, I'm not kidding. I would really be willing to lose my right arm if I could know I was a Christian. And I'll sit down and I'll talk to a person like that. Sometimes it's hilarious. I mean, in a sad kind of way. If I know the person real well, I'll kind of joke around with them. And I'll say, that was one example. Do you always worry about things that don't bother you? That are not important to you? But sometimes I'll say things like this. A guy will come in, men in particular. Women are much more willing to say, much more willing to concede that they're being emotional. I'm remarried. My wife says it this way. She goes, oh, I know what it is. It's emotions. God made me this way. But guys don't talk like that as a general rule. Guys will tell you it's factual doubt. Oh, really? Yeah, it's factual. Because our patron saint is Mr. Spock. Live long and prosper. But see, if guys have a disadvantage, because if it's emotional, they don't turn that rock over and they keep thinking you pile the evidences on. So guys keep getting the books and keep studying the evidences and they don't get any better. In fact, they might get worse because it's emotional. C.S. Lewis says, after I became a Christian, there were some days when I wondered if Christianity was true. But when I was an atheist, there were a lot of days when it looked like Christianity was true. If you don't know how to tell your emotions where to get off, you can't be a good Christian. You can't even be a good atheist. You'll be nothing but a creature dithering to and fro dependent on the latest state of your digestion. Very insightful. You can tell Lewis is a veteran emotional doubter. So you have to unwind what you're saying to yourself. That's a psychological. In fact, if I had a lot more time, I could give you examples of ways to how it's relatively easy to reverse this. But let me give you the biblical case for those of you who don't trust psychology. Or even if you do, here's another path. There's a lot of biblical texts that tell you what to do about this. But my favorite is Philippians chapter 4. Verses 6 through 8, Philippians 4. And Paul makes four suggestions. I don't think these four suggestions are holy in the sense that you have to do four, and you have to do one, then two, then three, then four. I don't think that follows. But I do think he's making some suggestions that can work, and I'd like some of you to participate with me just to show you how powerful a couple of these are. But Paul says in Philippians 4, 6, be anxious for nothing. Now, he's not talking about doubt, but he is talking about anxiety. And the most common kind of emotional doubt, subcategory, most common kind of emotional doubt is anxious doubt. What if? What if we're wrong? Now, here's some secular. I mean, it can be secular, too. What if Russia pushes the button? Oh, well, that one's over. Okay. Well, what if I'm the first one to get AIDS from a towel in the men's bathroom? Well, AIDS doesn't come that way. Yeah, I know. That's my point. What if I'm the first one? I mean, that's the point about what if sort of questions, right? We kind of manufacture it, and then all of a sudden, it's like the more unlikely it is, the more we worry about it. That's just an odd thing. All right, Paul says, be anxious for nothing. By the way, the Greek indicates that the Philippians were currently in a state of anxiety. So they were worrying. And if you want a little side verse, 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your anxieties on him, for he cares for you. So there are passages where the writer acknowledges that believers can be anxious, for sure. All right. Paul says, first of all, Philippians 4, 6, there and following, he says, first of all, give it to the Lord. He said, pray and make your supplication known to the Lord. Give it to the Lord. Secondly, he says, with thanksgiving. Now, I'm going to separate these two because I think they're very, very powerful. So the first remedy I would say you can develop is prayer. Second, thanksgiving. Now, later he's going to say praise, and I know there's a difference between thanksgiving and praise, but let me just put those two together. Thanksgiving and praise. Thirdly, verse 8. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. I call it goody two-shoes verse. It's never important to you until you need it. Then it's important. Finally, whatever is true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. By the way, the Greek word for think means to think deeply and single-mindedly. It's sometimes translated meditate. Meditate on these things. So Paul says, thirdly, and psychologically, even the secular treatment of these things, the most common single step is to replace your thinking. Get rid of your anxious thought, replace it with a non-anxious thought. And Paul says, stop thinking about those anxious thoughts of verse 6 and think about what's true, pure, so on. And the verse 9 is a behavioral component. Paul says that those things you've seen in me, do those things. Do them. By the way, the Greek there means to keep doing them. So here's four suggestions. Pray, thanksgiving, and praise. Thirdly, change your thinking. And fourthly, practice. Practice, practice, practice. When's the best time to practice this? When you're hurting. When's the second best time to practice it? When you're not hurting. Because personality-wise, if you're a worrier, by the way, the people that we see the most, the states that we see the most, if you tend toward anxiety or obsessive-compulsive, I'm not saying obsessive-compulsive disorder, I'm not saying that. I'm talking about obsessive-compulsive type personalities, not disorders. But a person who obsesses a lot and a person who's anxious, they're the ones most frequently that are get themselves into this boat. And that's just who they are as people. You're probably not going to change your personality. You can control it. You can solve a good deal of it. But you're probably always going to fight it because that's you. So the best time to do it is when you're in the middle of it. Second best time is when you're not in the middle of it because you know you're going to be in the middle of it again. It just makes good sense. By the way, you can pay $200 an hour to learn how to do this if you want to. Or you can read Paul and learn how to do it free. Okay, now, if you guys can cooperate with me for just a second, I want to just use one of these. Praise. Now, many of you, I'm assuming you go to this church. I'm assuming many of you are Baptists. And Baptists aren't so good at praising. I think we're getting better. But 30 or 40 years ago, we were really slow. We don't want to praise God. You know why we don't praise God if you're Baptist? Hey, I'll tell you, I'll even make it worse. I was raised in the German Baptist Church. German Baptist Church, guys, we just didn't express any. You never touch anybody. You don't touch women for sure. You don't even touch a guy except to shake hands. It's like, don't show anything. Don't give have any emotions. But why don't you praise? Because somebody might think we're charismatic. In the 70s, that was a big deal. All right, but now since we're getting over that, right? Baptists are getting over our inhibitions. Somebody help me here. How many of you have been in an emotional state of mind, worked up about something, maybe some bad news that turned out not to be bad news at all, but you got worked up with what if, and you spend as much as 5 or 10 minutes praising the Lord or thanksgiving during that time? Maybe just time to go to church. But you had to be serious about it, right? You couldn't be standing up and singing the praise music and not paying attention to what you're doing. You had to be serious about it. All right, how many of you have been in an anxious state and you spent at least 5 or 10 straight minutes praising? Okay, what happens? Now, obviously, we haven't rehearsed this. I've done this in a lot of places with thousands of people. I mean, total. What happens when you praise during a upset, emotional time? Pardon? Okay, peace. Just throw out a whole bunch of answers. Peace. What else? That one usually comes a little bit later, but that's one of my favorite ones. Why do you change your perspective? You see it from a different viewpoint. What viewpoint do you think? You see your issue from God's viewpoint. Okay? What happens to your mood? What happens to the pain? Pardon? It maybe goes away, but at least diminishes, right? Have you ever seen it stop or almost totally stop and you go, wow, I got to do this more often? But then you ask yourself, what's on TV this afternoon? What's the football game? You forget about it, and then you just have to what if one time, and you're right back into it again. Because your focus is no longer on you. That's good. Do you know what? I've done these four things. I don't always do Ellis, I'll just do Philippians 4. I've said it to a lot of people, hundreds. I have never had a person tell me I did it and it didn't work. I've never had them say I did it and it didn't work. Here's what they say. Well, whenever I do it, it works, but then when I stop, it stops and the pain comes back. Oh, okay. And if I know the guy real well, I'll go, duh. Whenever I have a headache, I take ibuprofen and it goes away. And when I don't, it doesn't. And I keep my headache. I go, wow, you're smart. It's like, if we can develop that, why don't we develop these? They're called disciplines, right? We say a lot about disciplines today in the church. How come we don't discipline our thinking? Because, I mean, there's some lies involved in some of this. There's some misbeliefs. Here's some misbeliefs. Jesus sends saved people to hell. That's a lie. Here's another one. Christianity's probably false. You say, well, I didn't say that. No, you didn't say it's probably false, but you said it could be. Now here's a question. How sure are you of Christianity? Just factually. I don't mean like I'm not looking for this magical, holy, 100% sort of answer. I'm just saying, like when you're having these questions, how sure are you? And somebody might say, I don't know, 98%? I go, well, if you're 98% sure Christianity's true, why do you spend all your time worried about the 2% questions you're having? Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. Well, you're getting yourself all churned up for 2%. That's anxiety. The definition of anxiety, by the way, you want to have an anxiety attack? here's how you have an anxiety attack. The worst possible thing is going to happen, and it's going to happen now. And if it's something really, really important to you, that's the flint and steel. Depression frequently comes from hatred, anger, and lack of forgiveness. Watch out for those things. But they're manufactured. Most of them are manufactured from us. We choose not to forgive. We choose to what if. So they're self-induced. So now you're back to Ellis's ABC. It's not what happens to you. It's how you download what happens to you. It causes most of your pain. I give you 100 examples, but I'm at the end of my time here. And Matt, do we have any more time or are we done? 5 minutes. Well, I'll tell you what. If people, like I said, I think one of the best things I could tell you is the person, well, I've had several people who tell me it works if you do it. What you do is train yourself, train the habit. Lewis says it this way. C.S. Lewis says, train the habit of faith. He says it's not going to stay there by itself. When you commit to something, it's not going to just stay there in your belief. Oh, yeah, you always believe it the rest of my life. Doesn't mean you'll stop believing it, but belief wavers. So practice, and you might rehearse evidences to you for yourself periodically, but that's taking one medicine without the other medicine. You need to tell yourself, you need to, I will often, I picture grabbing myself by my shirt collar and pulling myself up to, and going, read my lips. Because people who practice this, people who will tell you how to practice it, the harder you say it to yourself, the faster it works, and the more completely it works. It's like mom calling you by your middle name. If you go, oh, I shouldn't be thinking like this, I'm just making myself nervous, I've got to stop this, it doesn't really work real well. But if when you're in the car and nobody can hear you, you roll the windows up, and if you say to yourself firmly, I'm sick and tired of you what-ifing all the time. You know the data, you know it's true. This is like that other subject and whatever subject you name, because there's secular examples, like I said, the AIDS one, the pushing the button one, maybe my spouse is untrue, when there's no reason to believe that whatsoever. I mean, some spouses are untrue, but you know, that you can be doing damaging things by thinking it's true and it's not. So you change your thinking to remove the pain. And like I said, you're probably not going to change it 100% of the time because it's you. That's your personality. If you're not prone to this, if you don't have those personality types, you're not prone to this, just be thankful. Seriously. People come and see me, they'll say, I wish I could be like Mary. I wish I could be like Bob. They just believe. It's so easy. And I say, doesn't this bother you? And they go, no. I'm thinking, oh, what would I pay to not be bothered? But it's a discipline. You have to practice it. See, what you're saying is you wished you had their personality. You probably don't wish you had their personality. You probably just wished you didn't have this little thing. But it's you. And we have to work on this. So it does really work. So I'd encourage you to practice either the ABC method, locate the B's. I said the most important thing is how you download it. Ellis said it's good B's, good beliefs, reinforce it. Bad beliefs cause your anxiety or your depression or your anger. So watch what you say to yourselves. And the Bible says those things over and over again. So I think I'll stop there. But the key, I think, is practice-oriented. And it's key because I started this message by saying, we need to look for ways to practice apologetics. And if it works, what better solution is there to have something that's A, true, and B, helps you be well adjusted to life? You can't ask for anything more than your faith than to be true and to help us to be well adjusted.